Welcome to our podcast, Forgotten Victims, The Forensic Interview.
Forensic interviewing traditionally has been associated with child victims. Over the past decade, there's been an evolution in the field of forensic interviewing where it's being applied to vulnerable victims of all ages, forgotten victims, victims with disabilities, mental health disorders, and older adult populations.
Today, Scott and I are back, and we are going to be talking about facilitated communication. Hey there, Scott.
Hey, Stace.
How's it going?
It's going. Let's talk. Let's get into it.
All right. Awesome. So I think it would probably be helpful if we first start by addressing what facilitated communication is. So can you give a little bit of a definition for our listeners, maybe people who aren't as familiar with facilitated communication?
Sure. Facilitated communication can be considered like assisted typing or supported typing. It's pretty much a technique that involves a person with a disability either pointing to pictures or letters or objects on a keyboard or communication board with somebody physically supporting them, the facilitator. It's usually by hand, by the wrist or the elbow or shoulder.
Okay, so, and it requires some sort of facilitator person, support person, assisting, right? The person who
yes.
is communicating, the person with the disability. Okay. And I heard you say also that could be like a board or typing. So these can be like low tech or more high tech sort of devices.
Correct.
Okay. And that's a lot of what we see too in people using AAC independently as well, as they can be really low tech or really high tech. So the devices that you've seen people using in facilitated communication, are they personalized kind of like what we see with other forms of AAC?
It varies significantly. I will tell you that unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on where you are in this issue, it's been fully discredited. There's no scientific validity to facilitated communication. It really shouldn't be taken as valid. With that being said, I have worked with an individual with a disability who did use facilitated communication, and I happened to help facilitate. And she was able to answer questions that I didn't know the answer to. So the data says, depending on who you believe, about 80 to 90% of the time, the facilitation is the words and language of the facilitator. So if that's the case, certainly discredited as being valid. But that means 10 to 20% of the time, it's really the person's voice. And that was the case for this individual that I had worked with. But as a general rule, it's not really valid. And people use it with different types of disabilities. It specifically, in many cases, could be used with people who have dyspraxia or apraxia. It's a motor disorder that they need just some tactile grounding to be able to point to numbers or letters. But it's been misused over the years. So unfortunately, for the people that it's real, it's been unreal for too many people to be a valid form of communication.
Right. So even those like 2 out of every 10 people, right, who maybe it's working for, there's still not enough data to tell us that it's a good, reliable form of communication for people.
Yeah.
Because there's 40 on the other side.
Yeah. The evidence is just not there. So I'm pretty sure the American Speech Language Hearing Association, the ASHA, has a position statement on this that it's, you know, that it should not be used.
Well, and it's something that comes up in training a lot for us when people are asking about facilitated communication. And our stance has always been in a forensic interview that it's not a reliable form of communication for all the reasons that we've talked about. And it's interesting because then people start asking about things that, you know, seem like almost maybe less important to them. Like, well, what if you're asking the person like what they want to drink? It's like, well, at the end of the day, it's still, we don't want to misrepresent what someone either experienced or what they want by them not being the actual communicator. And I think that that's really where a lot of the ethical issue comes in here with the use of something like facilitated communication.
Yeah, we really want somebody's voice. And when the data says that 90%, 80, 90% of the time, it's not their voice, it's problematic regardless of what you're asking. That problem is exacerbated certainly in the context of forensic interview. but as you said, even for daily needs.
Mm-hmm.
So if people use it and outside of the forensic world, and it really is the person's voice, and they are able to communicate things, great. People can use that personally, just in the professional setting. And isn't there, didn't you tell me about some Netflix documentary that you wanted me to watch about this? So maybe, am I re remembering that correctly, Stace?
You are. So the only reason I know about it is also from our trainings, from our participants saying like, hey, have you seen this? And I heard it enough times from people that I said, okay, I need to watch it so that I know what I'm talking about when people ask about it. And so there's this woman, this professor named Anna Stubblefield, and she was a university professor. And I actually think that Netflix did a good job with the series because it really, I think, gave a lot of information. You can sort of
What's the name of the series for
It's
our
called Tell
listeners?
Them You Love Me.
Tell them you love me. Okay.
Right. So it was this professor, and she had a student, and the student has a brother. The brother's name is Derek, and Derek has cerebral palsy. And Anna had some experience working with people with disabilities, facilitated communication. So
This
she got
professor.
the professor, yes,
Yeah,
got
thank
into
you.
a conversation with her student, who again was the brother of this individual. And the brother started asking questions, and Anna said something like, oh, I think I can help, you know, your brother maybe with this thing we call facilitated communication. And so what the documentary shared was that Anna, the professor, had been exposed to this idea of facilitated communication for most of her life because Anna's mother also worked with people with disabilities. So there's like generations of people, you know, working with the population. And what it was originally described, Scott, is just as you're saying, facilitated communication is like supportive touch to like the shoulder or to the elbow. But
Or
in this,
wrist or hand.
yeah, or a wrist or hand. In this case, and again, this is how it was depicted. It wasn't actual video footage of what was happening. I was de depicted and described was that Anna had like grip of his full hand, was like squeezing his wrist and like only exposing his pointer finger. And that was facilitated communication.
I've seen that technique before.
Yes. And that's where I think, right, we get into some of the trouble of what you're talking about. Like, how can we tell who's actually communicating here? So, with this particular case, you know, it started off with him like taking classes and answering questions in class. And then it turned into what Anna, the professor, described as a romantic relationship between the two of them to the point where she claimed that he was consenting to sexual activity between the two of them. And then there was all sorts of conversations about, you know, consent, and that's stuff that we've talked about on this podcast before, Scott, as people with disabilities, and, you know, consent to sexual activity and some of the questions that come along with that. So that was like one piece
Yeah, we
that
have a whole podcast on that if folks are interested.
we do check out another episode because we don't have time to go over it all again. But then it was, you know, this issue of was it actual consent from the person or was it the facilitated communication that was happening by Anna that, you know, she felt like she had his consent or did that not happen at all? So lots of sort of controversy around both consent and the issue of facilitated communication with this case.
So what happened to her?
So she was ultimately charged and convicted and sentenced to 12 years in prison. But then she actually ended up appealing after a shorter period of time. I think she ended up serving like 2 years. And it was determined through that appeal that her conviction was overturned because they had omitted facilitated communication as a defense, and that somehow infringed on her rights as a defendant. So, yeah, she's not in prison
An
anymore.
invalid form of communication infringed upon her rights.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because they didn't allow it in.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
So
guess I'll have to check out the documentary. All
I
right.
think you
So, yeah, so what do we do instead? Is really like what for folks listening and who are coming to contact with this, well, what do you do instead? I
Yeah,
mean, I
great.
have thoughts. I was just posing the question to
Yeah,
you.
no, I think you should go first, Scott. What should people do instead?
Well, we should do what we always do, right? We want to understand the full range at which people communicate. People communicate in many different ways, even people that we label quote unquote nonverbal. We have a podcast on that as well. People can communicate with devices, gestures, words, lots of different ways. So I would identify the full repertoire in which people communicate. I would find it difficult to believe, hard to believe, if you will, that somebody's sole means of communication is facilitated communication only. If it is, I'm not sure what you do there. I think I'll suggest what you can do. But if it's other means of communication, then I would use those that and then validate those in the techniques that we train on. If facilitated communication is the only thing, and I would not do this with a forensic interview, but if it's a safety concern, what you want to do is you want to ask the person the question and without the facilitator in the room, and then you bring the facilitator back and have them respond. In other words, so here's an example. This is because I didn't really believe it when I was first working with, and we'll just use Stacy, the young woman who used, I'll just use Stacy as a name.
That's not confusing at all.
Yeah. I'm just using Stacy. I'm just going to use Stacy.
Okay.
So I wasn't really sure whether this was valid or not. So I would say something like, okay, Stacy, I'm going to give you the number 1972, and then we're going to bring your facilitator back in here, and then you type out that number. And then she nodded her head. Facilitator comes in. I go, okay, what's the number? And 1972. The facilitator couldn't have guessed 1972. Mm-hmm. So that style you could use to validate, I still see problems with that for a forensic interview. Mm-hmm. But if it's a health and safety concern and you want to make sure that you're getting the voice of the person, then that could be a technique that certainly might not work with anyone. There may be people who have additional intellectual disability that may make it difficult for them to remember the question or remember the answer, but that style could be something that you could use if it's a safety issue and you wanted to increase the likelihood that it was actually the person's voice.
So more of like a minimal facts interview, right? Might be okay asking minimal questions if we have some sort of validation first that this person happens to be in that 10 to 20% where maybe they're the communicator and not the facilitator doing it.
Yeah. And that example of validating it, I don't know if there's another way to validate it. I'm open. If you have a thought, share it. Otherwise, people can email us and let us know if they think of other ways to validate it other than having the facilitator leave the room when we ask the question.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because, like you said, how could that person have known that you said 1972 unless, you know, they had the room wired or something? Yeah.
And I remember there was a song that came on the radio, and when I was doing some work with her, and I said, who sings this song? And she made a noise, and I said, do you know? And she nodded her head, and I went and facilitated, and she started typing PHIL. Space CO. And I was like, oh yeah, Phil Collins. That's right. So she answered questions that I had that I didn't know the answer to.
So I guess I'm glad you brought up that example because I had another question, Scott, that I was thinking about. With facilitated communication, could more than one facilitator work with the same individual as another sort of test or thought or theory? Would that be another way to sort of validate if we get the same response even with a different facilitator?
Yeah, I would say that would increase the reliability a little bit. The other piece of that would be the challenge there would be some people require a specific technique mm-hmm. on how to facilitate. And I guess you could teach two people that because this young woman, it was a specific technique that I had to learn. So just talking out loud about it. Yeah, I think you could. You could have a facilitator, two different facilitators. And then of course the trade-off is you're asking somebody the same question multiple times.
Right.
Which we try to avoid doing.
Yeah, so maybe not necessarily from like an interviewing standpoint, right? We wouldn't want to traumatize people over and over again by asking the same thing. But if we were to do sort of the validity test that you're talking about with more than one person, would that offer any additional validation to, you know, it's the person and not the facilitator answering the questions?
Yeah, potentially, but it's rife with all sorts of problems too. So, for example, let's say it's a quality of life thing. You want to know what they want for breakfast, and you say, "I'm going to ask you what you want for breakfast." When your facilitator's in here, you bring the facilitator in. Then you say, "Yeah, I guess you would do it without repeating the question in front of the facilitator." Then you would just say, "Okay, answer the question that I just asked you," and the facilitator would have to try to facilitate it. And you would, if it was really their voice, you'd get what they wanted for breakfast. Otherwise, you'd get something else. So you'd have to keep the facilitator blind to the question, if you will, and then repeat the question to the individual. That would validate it for me.
Okay. Yeah,
A
maybe
little bit, a little
a
bit.
little bit. Well, then,
Well,
of course.
yeah, I mean, I guess in that sense, but not for a forensic interview. Again, we're talking
Right.
about.
Well, even as you're saying it, though, I'm thinking about experiences with, and I'm going to pick on my children for a second, where they come down and they say, "Mom, I want waffles today." And then I make waffles. They're like, "No, I said pancakes." Right. So it's like there's also the element of human error where could someone change their mind between facilitator and, you know, want one thing one minute and then change their mind and want something different.
Yeah, when I would have no idea. So let's say I was the one orchestrating this validity piece, or anybody is. You as the validity facilitator, you don't know what they want for breakfast because they didn't tell you.
Yeah.
You're relying on the so it again, it brings a whole host of things. Just to recap, in the beginning, it is really, there's all the evidence says that it's not a valid means of communication, which again is frustrating because it's definitely valid for some people.
Well, that was one of the things too with the documentary that I watched. Because that was, I think, the brother's biggest argument. He's like, how come she's the only one, right, that can facilitate him to communicate this way? And I think that was what was really hard for the family because the professor had convinced them somehow that she like unlocked his mind, right, were sort of the words that she had used. And
Yeah, that's
that.
problematic because you would think that anybody should be able to facilitate if they know the right technique. That reeks of an abuse case that I consulted on, where the caregiver said, "Oh, I understand what this person's saying, and they're saying they want to have a relationship and they want to do this and they want to do that, and like nobody else on the planet could understand it." And I interviewed this person, and this person is about as close to the true nonverbal in the sense of no ability to communicate anything, needs, wants, gestures, signs, no reliable communication. It's on video. I got to get the video from the DA. It's spectacular. I absolutely fail at communicating with this individual, but this is a person that somebody else who. There's an allegation against this person saying, "Oh, no, I know what they're saying, and this is what they want, but nobody else can, and I couldn't communicate it. I'm not that I'm the human whisperer, but yeah." So that's what it reminds me of a little bit too, like, oh, only I am the one to do this, and what she was able to do benefited her, if you will,
Right, absolutely.
and it's
Yeah.
possible she believed it. I she may be delusional. It is funny, the last name Stubblefield, considering the Dana Stubblefield case that I had. But
Yeah, the last name.
yeah, so if your last name's Stubblefield, don't let it be ruined by these two individuals.
Right. Yeah,
Well, that's
so
all. I'm open to sharing anything else that might be useful, Stace, if you think so. Otherwise, we can wrap this episode up.
yeah, I think this has been useful, helpful, good reminders that we don't use facilitated communication and the reasons why, human error being a big part of that, and really
Right, and
just
human manipulation.
right, and biases coming out, even really well-intended people
Sure.
who aren't trying to abuse people with disabilities still can certainly have error and have bias and you know, think one thing and answer their own likes and preferences, which also happened. You just have to watch the documentary, Scott. There's so many examples.
I'll get on it. I'll get
I
on
know
it.
we do this in our work, so it's hard sometimes when we watch Netflix to, you know, think about work, but it was, I thought it was really important just because we were getting asked so many questions about it. So I'm glad we could address it here at the podcast as well. All
Great. Hope this was useful for folks.
right. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Stace.
Thanks for listening. For more information about the work being done by Modell Consulting Group, visit our website, modellconsultinggroup.com, or follow us on social media.